My name is Eric, and I'm an addict. And I want to just thank God, man. They got a go-go going on right now, right? And they got three meetings going on. And, you know, the two go-go bands they got are very popular bands in our area, you know. So, you know, mentally I go upstairs. But y'all told me don't do that when I first got here. You say, never go upstairs unsupervised. You know. I mean, my sponsor told me, he said, Eric, when you get 10 years, I'll tell you the same thing, and that's don't go upstairs without taking an adult with you. Right. And every time I go upstairs without taking an adult with me, God always revealing to me that he's God, not me. So I want to thank y'all for, like, filling this room tonight at 12 o'clock, and we're talking about resentments, the silent killer, right? But what one of the most painful things I've ever experienced in this process of recovery was finding out that I belong to God, but living like I belong to Satan. My clean date is April 18th, 1994. Next week, I'll celebrate 14 years. Right. At the end of my story, man, I was in this abandoned house on 15th Street. Everybody got a 15th Street. It don't make a difference. It don't make a difference where you're from. Believe me, you got a 15th Street. And, you know, me and some guys who hung out with each other, you know, we were living in a place called Dereliction, right? We had the same clothes we had on for 6 and 8 months. You know, the bathtub was full of feces, urine bottles everywhere, dead rodents. And we would argue over who's going to get the flip on the antenna that's been flipped 10 times already. So when I came to Narcotics Anonymous, I came into the Betty Ford Clinic over there on the East Coast, right? Now, I came to Salvation Army. Let me tell you. And it took me on a tour of this place, right? And I seen the big screen TVs in the rooms, and you know, they had this big old walk-in kitchen, and you know, coming off this crack thing, you know, I ain't eat in a long time. I mean, my story was soup trucks, right? I cut them off 4 times within an hour. And so this walk-in kitchen was big, man. Make 2 of these rooms. And then they took us upstairs, and these rooms had clean sheets on the bed, and out back was a pond and a full basketball court. And they told me to sit in the lobby while they do the evaluation to see whether they was going to take me in there or not. And I remember how humble I was that day praying that they had a bed for me. And the same humility I had that day is the same humility I need now. And all I need and all I can do is ask God to remove me and come in, right? My drug of choice was anything that I could get free. I'm going to tell you that too. I've experienced everything, trust me. But one of my favorites was Love Boat, right? I don't know if y'all know about Love Boat. That's PCP, right? And every time I would smoke this boat, right, I would take my clothes off, right? It didn't make a difference where I was at. I could be at a go-go dance, and the line be around the corner, and I smoke it, and my clothes come off. So let's check it out. One Sunday, I'm in the park, and I smoke the boat, and I take my clothes off, and I'm walking down this busy street naked with a beer in my hand, and I turn in my family church on a Sunday morning. The church is packed, big old large church. I walk down the aisle, and I give the father the beer, right? Police run in the door. They stop the police and tell the police, you know, we got him. Y'all leave, we have him. And they cover me up. They say, Eric, it's going to be all right. That was my favorite. They said, Eric, it's going to be all right. And they stepped me in the back, and they prayed for me. They counseled with me. As soon as I left, I knocked back on the guy's door again and bought two more bags. I went to jail, man. And my sister and them was sending me canteen money. And the only thing I could do with my canteen money was to buy dope with. You know, I what I'm talking about is that I couldn't stop using, man. They would catch me for running off with their package and beat me with the bats. And you know what I mean? And I still couldn't stop. So I remember like sitting in this coma, man, and waking up out of this coma, and the get well balloons and the cards and all that stuff was there, and I spotted some money on the table, and I asked the doctors who money was that, and they said, well, that's your money. I said, well, I'll be back, right? And they say, oh, you can't. I said, man, I'll be back. And they said, you can't go nowhere. I said, man, I'll be back. And they made me sign all these papers that I was leaving without their authority. And I went right back up the street on 15th Street and cop from the same people who put me in the hospital. Right? And like 30 minutes later, I was stealing stashes again. Right? Our literature talks about, man, that the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop using. And going to talk about how we can be prayed over, counseled with, beaten, locked up, but an addict ain't going to stop unless he want to stop. And the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop. With the desire, miracles can take place, and I'm looking at them now. But without the desire, you're doomed, man. Right? You have to, like, want recovery, Eric. You have to want to, like, immerse in God's beauty. You got to want to, like, implement the principles in your life, right? I'm talking about, man, like my first year when I came in here, I had issues, man, right? My little nephew was killed at 87, right? And I got clean, and I would cry, man. I was being in this treatment center, and I would cry all the time when I was eating. And they would come and hug me and rub and say, Eric, it's going to be all right, because I missed him, man. And this, he was like 15, 16 years old when they killed him. And he wasn't supposed to go out like that. But what was more deeper than that was he shouldn't have never been in the lifestyle. And as a result of me being in it before him, I always had this like resentment that I played a part in his death. Right? So I like hated God for that. You know, our third step talks about how we have to be honest about our belief, man. Like, one of the things I didn't want to do, like, was to honestly say how angry I was to God, man. You know, my life consisted of, like, foster homes, institutions, right? And I always felt as though I wasn't important in, like, the surroundings of my immediate family. Right, but this program, man, what it would do for you, it would take away your excuses, right? It would give you a vision, and if you buy into the vision through the step process, you will find out that not only are you special. Not only are you special, but you belong to somebody that's special, right? And that, like, whatever your life, whatever avenue your life took, Eric, it was already preordained to do that. And one of the things I hate to accept is that I don't like being used as a vessel, especially if I don't know that I'm being used like that. Right? I need to know that you're using me. Right? So, like the resentment that the basic text talk about is like repeating our past and visualizing it again and again. Right? It's a painful thing, man, to go back and visit something that you want closed up. Right? It's a painful thing to have honestly believed you have accepted something and one day it shows back up and you realize you've just been tolerating it. Right. So one of the things that Narcotics Anonymous does, it gives me an out. Right. At the end of our first step, it talks about how this program is really an opportunity for me to be rescued from insanity, depravity, and death. Right. And I'm so stupid, I needed to be taught in a simplistic way. So my sponsor say, Eric, the first step is saying that a funeral procedure was about to take place. Right. And your second step is trying to introduce you to the person in the casket was you. Right. So I had to come to believe that the power to stop the funeral procedure, like, because. That the power to stop the funeral procedure is the power I need to turn my will and my life over to. See, one of the things about a second step in my life is that I've always tried to find God in the second step instead of trying to find myself. You know, I've always was trying to visualize the hope and immerse in the principles, but I never tried to be restored to my original state or condition. Right, so the restoration process took a while for me. Right, I mean, I had evidence. My sister was celebrating 7 years when I got here. Right, so when you talk about evidence, it wasn't really about what folks had. I'm talking about my experience. It wasn't about like the Cadillac, the Gator shoes, or none of that stuff for me, because the dope boy had all that anyway. That wasn't even important to me. What was important to me was that I needed to see something that I could identify with as being a miracle. And I saw it, man, on her 7th year anniversary, because I've seen her OD so many times. I've seen her, like, going to seizures and all that stuff. So for her to be, like celebrating any clean time was a miracle within itself. Right, so one of the things the old timers used to tell us was resentment was like urinating on yourself. The only one feel it is you. Right? It's like you can't walk around this program hating people. Right? The resentment is one of the key components to the triangle self-obsession. Right? And unless you address them like you would die in this program. They used to say, work the steps or die. They just say, work the steps or die. And it was some people around here displaying behavior that wasn't working the steps and they wasn't dying. So a lot of those cliches was really like debatable. Right? But once you start investing in the program of Narcotics Anonymous, which I believe is the 12 steps, 12 concepts, the 12 traditions in our literature, then you begin to realize that the answer is in the steps. The answer is in the traditions. The answer is in the concepts, and the answer is in our literature. So the triangle self-obsession, the IP pamphlet says, we have a disease that forces us to seek help. Right? It talks about how we are given this chance. We are given this last chance, man, and how we must break this triangle self-obsession. We must grow up or die. We can die in this program by acting like we're children when we should be trying to grow up. And when I say we, I'm talking about myself. Because I've done a lot of stuff outside of character in the program of Narcotics Anonymous. Right, I've done a lot of stuff. So my 5th year, I got diagnosed with a brain tumor. Right. And if you're new, I'm really trying to say that we don't use no matter what. We're here to take your excuses away from you. I got diagnosed with this brain tumor. Right. And when I got diagnosed, I was afraid. Man, the people telling me I got a tumor this big that's been growing since birth, and the word birth took me back to my childhood, man. And my childhood brought back up the resentment, right? And I became afraid, and I started crying. He said, Eric, you know, we got to operate immediately, man. You know, and they went and done the operation. And I came home, and a week later, my nose started leaking, and they had to do the operation all over again. So I don't need no assurance how good God is. Trust me, I know that already. Right? What happens, man, in this process is that I have to come to believe that no matter what past mistakes I've made, that it's still possible for me to get better through the steps of Narcotics Anonymous. Right? And the harm that I've caused, it was going to take like some identification. And the way I done my fourth step in this program, and I remember doing it, and when I seen it for what it was, I could see all the steps come to life. Right? I could see my sixth step. I could see like my fourth step. I could see my eighth step. Right? I could see all that once my sponsor edited, and I knew then that not only did I cause harm while I was using, that I have now created an eight-step list clean in Narcotics Anonymous. And the most painful thing was the list I had clean was longer than the one I had using. And it took people to tell me stuff like, our literature talks about how, like, it isn't until we come to NA that we realize that we, you know, we get obsessed with stuff that we never had a problem with while using. You know, because, you know, your humanness come to life is what I'm talking about. Your humanness come to life. So I was walking around the program, and I was feeling bad. I was feeling shameful, I was feeling guilty, and I was feeling pained up, and as a result of that, I wanted to feel better. I wanted to feel better. I came in this program on SSI. I came on this program not even graduating from junior high school. So it was a lot of stuff that I could see on paper that I should have been resentful for, right? That didn't have nothing else to do really with other people, but everything to do with myself. Right. So when I came here, it took people that was living the program, doing stuff. I remember a recovering addict named Jerome grabbed me one time. He used to take me with him everywhere, right? And he, you know, he was in the field, and we talking about evidence. We talking about attraction rather than promotion. He would take me places, and he would whip out this card and give it to folks. And you know what I mean? And that stuff like that amazed me, man. At our anniversary, the brother that's sharing down there in room 201, he pulled out a capsule of dirt from Africa and gave it to her. And that blew me away. I ain't even know that you really could go to Africa. You understand what I'm saying? My vision of Africa was Tarzan. I'm talking about the state I came here on. Right? But y'all said when the addict put the drug down and worked the program, wonderful things happen. Hey, lost dreams awaken, new possibilities arise. Right? And I always had dreams, man. I've always had dreams. Because I always hung out in TV land. Right? So all my dreams was in television, fantasy. Right? And I wanted to go to Hollywood, man. Right? And the World Convention landed in San Diego. And I remember touching down on the plane. And everybody going to their hotel room, and they looking at me like, what's up? Look, man, I didn't come here really to go to no convention. You do know that, don't you? I'm too close to my mark to worry about a convention right now. And I remember hitting the freeway, right? The broader the base, the higher the pole of freedom. The World Convention in Baltimore, my first convention. I got numbers, man. I met folks. And I remember hitting the freeway and calling an addict that I met in this program that's in L.A. And I said, man, guide me, man. I'm coming down. And I spotted the sign in the Hollywood Hills. And I started crying, right? And they're going to look at me like, you crying, man? Man, you don't know how much crack I smoked believing I would never make it here? What are you talking about, man? Then we up in Beverly Hills. I'm talking about an addict that couldn't get off of 15th Street. I'm in Beverly Hills, man. I'm on the Hollywood Hills up there by De Niro's house. Overlook, oh my God. Wait a minute. Huh? Then they landed in Hawaii, the World Convention. Oh, you know Hawaii 5-0 was on TV. Y'all lost y'all mind, man. Y'all lost y'all mind. I don't know where y'all from. Huh? Look, I'm in Hawaii. And I'm walking down like the beach, man, drinking a cone of coffee, crying. I'm on the USS Arizona, man, embracing spirits that is underwater. Right? Ho, I went back to school, man, at 41 years old. And graduated with my high school diploma, man. Hold up. At 41, man, my original hero was my brother, man. My brother was like a genius, man. My brother was like, even though we was in poverty, where I come from, my whole area was in poverty. Ain't no, look, wasn't no hope nowhere. I don't know where you from. Everybody was on state checks. Ain't nobody have a door key. But it was a lot of love, man. And my brother, in 74 was Valor Victoria, man. My brother, him and I, man, you know, he was my original hero. And as kids, we was always together in foster care. They kept us together. So, you know, my oldest brother, and we used to watch college football and Notre Dame. Man, Notre Dame was like, oh, man. So when the letters got to coming, Notre Dame letter came. Man, I was so happy. I swear I thought he was going to Notre Dame. And he picked Dartmouth. I ain't speak to him for 2 years. I say, you picked what? Look, I say, Dartmouth? I ain't never heard of Dartmouth. I'm like, you did what, man? Dartmouth. I said, man, we supposed to be up South Bend. Man, what are you talking? And he picked Dartmouth. Dartmouth is one of the best schools in the country, man. It's an Ivy League school. Right? So, I graduated, and I done the high school. You know, I was chosen to do the speech. They didn't know I was a charismatic. They didn't know what they was doing. So they picked me out of the class to do the speech, and, oh, Lord, I spoke. Hey, look, but look. So at 41 years old, we talking about living a miracle, right? So, look, I want to go to college, man. Why not? Right? I graduate this June with my degree, right? I'm talking about, man, fulfilling a dream, putting yourself in position to let God move you, and you can put check marks by every goal, which is the dreams that you have on your list. I ain't tell y'all about Hollywood. I ain't tell y'all about Motown, huh? Oh, look, man. The call came Easter weekend for Detroit. So I test down the Metropolitan, right? And you do know I ain't really come up there to speak at no convention, don't you? Right. So we go to Hitsville, right? And I met some addicts. I met some new addicts in Detroit. I met so many people on this journey, man. I met Sydney, right? I mean, I don't want to call no names, man, because, you know, I'm going to forget somebody. So I met all y'all, right? And this has been one of the most beautiful experiences I ever experienced in my life, man. Right. So one of the things about a resentment is, in my fourth step, I had to find out what birth resentments. Resentments just don't come. A resentment ain't something that just show up. It's something that produce resentments, like anger, right? Envy, right? That's a dangerous thing, man, to envy somebody that you don't even know. Right? Hatred. When it should be self-hatred. So it was imperative that I sought through the confusion and contradiction to not only take the blame off the other people, but to take ownership, because I didn't want to keep hurting in the fellowship or the program of Narcotics Anonymous. And it was a way out. It was two steps, man, that could unlock it all, man. Oh, my God. I'm trying to stick with the traditions, but he's so good to me, it don't make a difference if they ever ask me to share no more. Let me tell you something, man. Hey, look, steps 8 and 9 was the key to it all, man. You know, every defect have an opposite, which is an asset. Right? So what we do, we list the defects, we list the assets, we fold the paper, and we focus only on the positive. Right, but the list had to be made. And the 8-step list was painful because it left fear, right? It left anger. It left all this stuff. And hey, check it out in closing. You ever have to go to a lavatory, right? Say if you're at a ball game and, you know, it's a 7th-inning stretch or something, or at the mall, and the bathroom's all crowded and you got to wait, right? Say you got to go real bad and it's coming up, right? And if the person in front of you don't let you up, you're going to urinate on yourself, right? At that moment, that position that I'm in, that's a posture of an 8-step. An 8-step isn't designed to bring freedom. That's the 9-step job. An 8-step is for me to embrace the pain that I have caused on others and to be truly sorry for producing it. It is designed for me to, like, implement and give out a newfound humility, right? So I'm in this line, and the shit coming out, and if I don't hurry up and get up, and I ain't talking so much. Yeah, that's what I said. But look, I ain't talking so much. Look, I ain't saying so much about the feces. The shit, in this case, is the defects of characters, right? The shit is the defects of characters. And if the people don't let me up, they're going to come out. I'm going to spit up on people. And I don't want to do that. So I got out. But I need some help. Right? God. Anybody I've harmed. Look, man. The purpose of the 9-step is to let the shit out. And once the shit come out, that's the freedom that the 9-step give. You ever let it out and say, whoa. Right? Huh? That's the freedom that you get from making the amends process. That's the freedom you get from making the restitution, right? And then you implement in the service, and what happens between 8 and 9 is that a character change. You don't sleep with nobody's wife no more. You don't hurt nobody no more. You don't gossip as much no more. You begin to realize that the people you have picked in your life as friends are not really friends. They're really just pallbearers waiting for you to die. You come to find out that what you need is some courage, some faith, and commitment. You sought through prayer and meditation. You ask God, like, to help you out of here because you know you're a coward. And he tell you stuff like, okay, I'm going to let you off the hook. I'm going to whisper something to you in the spirit. But in order for you to hear me, you got to do a 10th step and clean that garbage out. Your problem, Eric, is that you got a cluttered spirit, right? And it's like a messy house. But you can't hire a maid to clean it up. You got to clean it up yourself, right? No matter how many times you try to walk past the trash, it's still there, right? So after this institution, you know, this institutionalized cleaning, internal, right, you are able to talk to God through prayer and meditation, and he tell you stuff like, look, Eric, in order to get rid of those folks that you don't have enough courage to leave, all you got to do is go to school, get a good job, do some service work, and then they'll leave you alone. You think I'm lying? Try it. They'll leave you alone because you're no longer indulging in the mess. Darkness can't follow light, man. It ain't created like that. So it's an honor, man, to show up anytime, anywhere. We're going to sit back and we're going to let Mike bless us, man. I'm going to keep coming.
And without any further ado, we're going to have Michael M. from Tucson, Arizona.
Tucson. Oh, How you doing? I'm an addict. My name's Michael. I'm clean today by the grace of my higher power and the fellowship in Narcotics Anonymous. I want to start by thanking Eric. I'm truly grateful. That was special. Thank you. And I want to thank the committee. This was a last moment opportunity to be of service, and you know, I guess if something's going to get sprung on you, resentment's as good as anything, because I can't imagine an addict who doesn't have them. Yeah. I'm grateful to hear Eric share, and I'm grateful to hear his story, because story-wise, we have nothing in common except for the stuff that brings us here, you know, pain and inability to deal with our feelings, you know, but... Can you hear me all right? Okay, I can't hear me, so it's a little weird, but I'm going to... there we go. All right, how's that? Is that better? Okay. That's hitting the wrong microphone there. I can't tell you why I was resentful from an early age, except that I'm an addict. I didn't grow up hard. You know, I grew up in a middle class or maybe even upper middle class neighborhood. My parents are both college educated people. All of my needs were met as a child. Nobody ever beat me. Nobody ever treated me bad, abused me physically or sexually or emotionally. My folks split up when I was 7. But I think that... Even before then, I suffered from this disease. I know that I had feelings that were more than I knew how to deal with at the very early age. And pain and fear and frustration and disappointment and shame and guilt overwhelmed me. And I didn't know what to do with those feelings when they happened. And I know that although all of my needs were met, not all of my wants were met, I was not spoiled, but I know that I had for myself this sense of entitlement that came, as best as I can tell you, only from my disease of addiction. And so my ability to generate resentments came on very early because I always felt like I was entitled to whatever it is. So when the answer was no, when I wanted it to be yes, whatever it was, it went on this list, you know? And I kept an inventory in my head about all the times that stuff didn't happen the way I thought it was supposed to in my life. And I mean, I'm talking from a very early age. And my life was a cycle of things not going the way I wanted them to, and trying to convince you the next time I wanted something to go my way, why this time it should, because don't you see last time it didn't and this other time it didn't? I could whip out that list as long as it was, trying to convince you don't get on this list with everybody else, turn it around and make it happen the way I wanted to, even if it's not. I was the exception to every rule. And so by the time I got to Narcotics Anonymous, I was, you know, that classic definition of an addict, you know. I was an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. And I had banged my head against every wall that I had come up against. I spent a lot of years in the Air Force in a fairly structured society where the rules are pretty clear. They're in black and white. They're in books on shelves. And there was still always a reason why I was the exception to the rule. You know, I mean, I got... silly resentments over silly stuff, where the school that I went to when I was in grade school, they did this musical every year, you know, and I was really excited about this, and I was waiting. It was about fifth and sixth graders got to be in this musical, and I knew the teacher who organized it. He was kind of a friend of the family, and I waited, you know, in third grade and fourth grade so I could get to fifth grade so I could be in this musical. I was a talented kid. I could sing. It was sort of a foregone conclusion I would be part of this. the year, in my fourth grade year, some little girl who was in the sixth grade didn't get a chance to be in the musical. You couldn't just be in it by default. You had to audition. She didn't get to be in it, or she wasn't going to get to be in it because she didn't pass the audition. And her mom bitched so hard that what they said was, all right, well, now it's not going to be the fifth and sixth graders. It's going to just be the sixth graders. I'm sorry. So my fifth grade year, I didn't get to be in the musical because it was just the sixth graders. And then, see, halfway through my fifth grade year, they promoted me to sixth grade, but they'd already picked the cast of the whole damn thing. So, you know, I didn't get to be in the musical, so that was on the list. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that I'm talking about. You know, years later, I'm in the Air Force, and we're overseas in the Philippines, and it's my last trip there, and they had this great rum in the PI. You know, it was low in alcohol content, but it tasted like mother's milk. I don't know, man. And so I had to take a couple of bottles back. All right, well, maybe a case. And so I said to my boss, hey, man, I'm going to, you know, we got these boxes of cargo going back. I'm going to put some rum in here. Are you cool with that? And he said, yes. Now, I know I'm not allowed to do it. He's kind of naive. He's an officer. He doesn't know. But I know I'm not allowed to do it. So I put this stuff in here, and I wrap it all up nice and tight. And I said, now, you got nothing else to go in these boxes because I'm gonna seal them up now. You got nothing else to go? Right, nothing else to go. Okay, so I put my rum in there, close up the boxes. I bring it up. And he says, oh, I forgot some stuff. I'm going to go put it up there. I said, let me do it. He says, no, I'll take care of it. He goes up there. He puts the stuff in. Somebody says, well, what's that? Right? I get in trouble because there's rum in there. I didn't get written up or anything. But 6 months later, I didn't get to go to Australia. It's not fair. It's not fair. It's not about I broke the rules. It's about I got screwed. I can take anything and I can twist it around to be about why it's not right and why it's all about poor me. And then I came to N.A. The solution's in the steps. The solution to this disease is in the steps. And Eric shared about that. And what I know is that the opportunity to talk about resentments for me came when I got to my fourth step. And Eric talked about work the steps or die. What I know is that it says, and it works how and why, about step four, that our experience is that addicts who do not work this crucial step relapse. Relapse is a fate worse than death for this addict. I don't know how it is for you. That's what I know. And I'd put off my four step for a good long while, but when I read that, when someone else read it in a workshop at a convention, I got off my ass. And I sat down and I worked on resentments, and I wrote about the musical, and I wrote about the rum, and I wrote about all the people who had not done my will, most of whom had just done what they should have done, you know. But, you know, what I learned through this process of writing about these steps was about, you know, my inability to live life on life's terms. I'd been hearing it in meetings all this time, but I really processed that when I got down to the fourth step. And I started writing about my resentments. And I realized that the one common denominator in all of my resentments, just like it said in the, well, back at that time, it was the working step four in Narcotics Anonymous IP, because we didn't yet have a step working guide. But, you know, I talked about people and I talked about institutions. And the one, you know, no matter what the resentment was, the common denominator that was there was an addict named Michael. And one place that it became incredibly clear for me was about my relationship with my father. And what I realized through the process of the four step is that my dad was only ever going to be who my dad was. And that the thing that had interfered in my ability to have the relationship that I always wanted with my father all those years was my expectation that he was going to be or should be somebody other than who he is. You know, my mom called me. I was in Japan for 3 years. My mom called me the last Sunday of every month at the same time for 36 phone calls. Every month, She called like clockwork. I was in the Air Force for 8 years, and I know my dad called me twice. He wrote letters, but I, you know, phone calls came twice. He was always happy to hear from me if I called him, but he called only twice. And I remember that. I remember one call, and I know there was a second one. I don't remember it. But I worked this step four, and I came to realize that my dad was doing the best he could. This is who he was. He didn't know how to be anybody else. And the problem was that I was so busy being upset with him not being who I wanted him to be that I was lacking the ability to appreciate that at least he was being who he was. Lots of people didn't have their dads around. You know, at least I had a dad. And I learned to work through that. My dad didn't know that that's what had happened for me. He was out here on the East Coast, and I was living in Utah getting clean. And I had just a little more than a year clean, and the phone rang, and it was my dad. And he said, I want to have a family vacation, and I want to pay for you and your brother and your brother's girlfriend to fly out so we can all get together and have a vacation as a family. I can't explain that any other way than my higher power working in my life, that no sooner had I learned through these steps, through this fellowship, through addicts like you teaching me how to live clean, to accept my father for who he was, then all of a sudden the guy on the other end of the phone was the person I always wanted him to be. I have no other explanation for that. But what I know is that when I went to visit my dad, it was the first time that we'd got to spend time together while I'd been clean. And he didn't even know I had a problem. He was on the other side of the country, and I talked a good game. When I left my dad and he took me to the airport, and back in those days you could walk somebody to the gate, and we went to say goodbye, my dad kissed me on the cheek. And he hadn't done that in 25 years, you know? And I got on that plane and I cried. And I continued to have the relationship that I always wanted with my father until he died in 2003. You know, and it was a result of learning how to deal with resentments in Narcotics Anonymous. Learning how to deal with them has not exempted me from resentments in Narcotics Anonymous. But I do know better today how to deal with them. I've learned how to share with you today when something that you have said doesn't feel okay to me. And if I can't share it with you right away because I'm not in a place that's healthy and safe, I have a support group of other addicts that I can bounce it off of first. I have a sponsor who really knows me. You know, he's pretty well inside my head because I do my job and I work my steps with him. And I can call him and I can say, hey, man. So, you know, stuff that's happened in recovery that recently I can talk about is being at a large convention, probably this size, maybe not quite this size, but a large convention, and a member of this fellowship standing at the podium and making a very bold statement about their choice of religious observation. And I don't believe that that's okay. It made me very uncomfortable to hear that, because what I've learned in Narcotics Anonymous and what our literature says is that we come here from many different places and we all have the freedom to stay clean here and to find our own spiritual path. And if part of your spiritual path is about a religion, that's great. But it may not be the same path that someone else has chosen. And when we're new here, we're so fragile. We're just looking for a reason to leave, a reason why it won't work for us. And if you start talking about your higher power by name And that higher power doesn't work for somebody else, it might be enough to keep them from coming back long enough to find out that they don't have to have that same higher power. You know, a lot of my resentment when I was growing up was about that kind of stuff. And thank I heard a speaker say recently on a tape, thank God for God. You know, I understood what that meant. Thank God for God. And I'll tell you that when I say God because it's got fewer syllables than higher power. It's just what works for me. And so if God makes you uncomfortable, you know, that's all right. Use higher power. Use what works. But stick around here long enough to know that you have the freedom here to find whatever it is that works for you. If you want to know about my higher power, please ask me after this meeting and I will gladly share it with you. But I won't tell you more up here representing Narcotics Anonymous about my higher power than that he is loving, caring, and greater than myself, which is what's suggested in our literature. That's all you need to know about my higher power when I'm sharing in a meeting. I was having a conversation downstairs just a little while ago with another addict. I got clean long enough ago, and I guess I'll say that my first meeting of Narcotics Anonymous was November the 11th of 1992, and I haven't found it necessary to use since that day. And when I got clean, there were still meetings you could go to where they would close the meeting with the Lord's Prayer. I didn't even know to be upset about that or to understand it. It wasn't something I grew up with, but I just learned to say it because other addicts were saying it. Until an addict said to me one time, that's a religious prayer and it has no place in Narcotics Anonymous, and I came to understand that. And it's not about having a resentment when someone tries to do that. It doesn't happen very often anymore, but it happened in Tucson a couple weeks ago. And the difference between the addict who got here 15 years ago and the addict that got here today is 15 years ago, if I had heard that, I would have been outraged and I would have had to get in the face of somebody at that meeting who let it happen or get in the face of the person who did it and tell them why it wasn't right and that they had no business. And today, what I have learned is that whatever it is I do, whether it's right, that I can do the right thing in the wrong way. And that whether it's about using the Lord's Prayer or whether it's about using language that may not be consistent with a clear message of Narcotics Anonymous, if I'm not taking you aside and I'm not sharing with you one-on-one in a loving and a caring way about why that may not be okay, then I'm more wrong than you are for saying whatever it is that you said, you know? And then I could be the one, if I'm afraid that because you use the wrong language or you close the meeting with an inappropriate prayer, you're going to run some newcomer out of here, but I attack you for it, I could run you out of here. And that's even more inappropriate because you did it innocently, or at least I assume so. I know better. I've been around long enough to know better. And that's the difference. I mean, I guess that's about resentments. And so I guess if the topic is resentments, the silent killer, then what I want to say is that today the resentments that can kill me are the ones that I don't deal with, the ones that I don't say something about. You know, it's if I'm silent that they kill me. But if I share with my sponsor, I share with my support group, and I find a way to deal with it and deal with it appropriately, then I get to stay clean and I get to heal and I get to recover here. And I want to thank you guys for listening. That's all I've got.
Will y'all help me to thank Eric J. from D.C. and Mike M. from Tucson, Arizona for giving a dynamite meeting and I like how they shared about this.